Hello there, good evening everyone. Thanks for coming along, my God. So many people, hello.
I wonder if we could get started by thinking about your early career, maybe even before your early career. About when did you know, or did you always know that you wanted to be a film composer, or even a composer? At what point did this become a reality for you?
Well, I never thought of becoming a film composer, but I always composed and I kept it a big secret. I thought it was bizarre. I had tunes in my head from as long as I can remember. My son came up, he's a talented guy. He said, Dad, can I ask you something? He said, do you hear tunes in your head all the time? And I said, well, welcome to the club, Patrick. because that's the way it's, this is about booming this mic, by the way. But yes, I've always heard, I used to embarrassingly conduct the test card when I was a kid. You know, those of you who are old enough to remember the test card before mega television all over the world, used to play light classics in between while they set up the studio. And I just, this music amazed me. But I was from a really, really incredibly musical background, and my father's 92 and still sings amazingly well. But I always heard tunes, I suppose, and but I never thought I'd ever do this. Never.
You studied piano and singing. That was really where you started your music.
Yeah, well, I was brought up in a house full of singers, and we had soirees in our house regularly. It was a part of the Celtic tradition. And it's still going on in terms of karaoke, you know, and you know, that kind of hi-choo-hoo. All that's to do with, and that's, people slag that, but it's not. It's to do with, like, you know, when people sing these melismatic figures in folk music, it's just crept into modern music. It's actually a very highly respectful way of singing, singing, but people sort of slag it as a sort of working class thing. But in fact, it's a really real piece of evolution in music. So I was brought up with variations of that, but plus really classy singing. And my father sang all the songs of John McCormack, who was a very famous tenor who was a contemporary of Caruso's. And he sang all these sort of Victorian sort of drawing room songs, as well as he was listening to Carla, it used to be all in Carla Borgonzi, Inza Pinza, Galacurci, you know, just a myriad of opera singers in the house. He would lie back, you know, with 12 kids and think for 1 minute. He could get silence to listen to these things, you know, these arias. And I remember one day Björling was singing Cedil de Manina, and he sang the top B flat, and something really extraordinary happened. I thought, oh my God, my dad's not a buffoon, you know. this stuff's amazing, you know. He's onto something here, you know. So it was and my mother would listen to Vicky Carr, and she would listen to Lena Horne, and they were always, my mother and my father were obsessed with diction, and I mean, Glaswegians are obsessed with singers. You know, and they still are. That's a rare singer, that's a rare singer. They really know about singers. And I was brought up with a really sort of critical ear about singers, and still, it's still the same. You know, I really recognize, you know, great technique and great, and I love writing for the voice. And I love to sing. But you were made to sing, you know, and everyone in the house was made. And you dreaded it coming on, it's my turn to sing, oh my God, you know. And it was awful because through puberty and your voice was doing all that. But I ended up, of course, accompanying all these singers. It was great training for your ear to accompany all these people busting into song.
So karaoke and opera is the trick to being a film composer.
Well, I think it's, you know, when I write melodies for, I mean, I'm a composer who writes melodies. I'm known as someone who writes, who's melodic, and I have to stop myself because very often they'll say, could you just cut the tune, please? We just want the harmonies, actually, and there's people talking up there. So that happens, but no, it's just, when I write a tune or write a counter-melody or whatever, the counter-melody, I suppose one of my idols is Schubert, you know, even a sort of passing counter-melody was always, it could stand on its own as a lovely little tune. He couldn't write a phrase without it sounding like a singer could sing it tomorrow, you know. So, and that's the way I write. I write, you know, I suppose subconsciously with a voice in mind.
Yeah. Okay. That's going to lead, I hope, onto something we're going to look at in a minute. But I just wanted to jump forward because you spent a lot of time working in theatre before you got into film.
Yeah.
And you you joined the Renaissance Theatre Company in the late 80s, which is Kenneth Branagh.
89.
So I'm just wondering about the transition from your theatre work to film. What were the differences there? Was it any difference, or was it just a natural evolution of what you were already doing in the theatre?
Well, in retrospect, I suppose it was, but not at the time. It was sort of terrifying to do a feature, especially when at the end, when Simon Rattle was going to be conducting, now Sir Simon Rattle. The whole thing was extremely daunting. Walton had, this is Henry V we're talking about, Walton had done his version with Olivier, and although I never watched the picture, I'd never seen the picture, I saw it 2 weeks after I'd scored her version. And I was just curious to see it after that, and I didn't listen to it. And I'd never had, I didn't recognize it. In fact, Simon Rattle came down, and he played one of the themes from it. I thought, thanks for that, Simon, thanks for that. Just a bit of a moment of ebullience, you know, he just got carried away. But no, I was daunted by the fact that, you know, I thought, my God, this is an enormous thing I've said yes to. So it was a natural progression, but I suppose I have, it sounds immodest, but I do have an innate sense of music and drama. I just, it's something I've, through the years, discovered I've got. I have no problem really coming up with a tempi for a scene, and it's something that, you know, I feel a good click. The boys who work with me will tell you that. And I've never really, I sort of took it for granted. So all these things, I suppose, led to the transition being not as traumatic as I thought it was going to be. A lot of people helped me, and still do help me, and help composers in film, schedules, etc. So it's, you're not an island. You need help. You know, as do the Renaissance painters and people who are commissioned or whatever. So there's times you can do the orchestration yourself. There's times you need help. There's times when I want to do it myself. But the transition. No, it wasn't that simple, but I actually hustled for the job, and I've never done it since. I lobbied David Parfitt, and David Parfitt lobbied Ken, and, you know, I was on his case. I was like a barnacle at the end of a whale, you know, I just would not let him go. I was terrified at the same time, absolutely. I'll never forget going into the first time I walked into Rush's, and I saw the big screen with the actors, and my legs almost gave away from me. I thought, what the? What have I done here? This, I can't do this. But you know, I just kept on going, and that's what we do now. You know.
And we're going to have a look at a scene from Henry V in a moment. But one thing that strikes me about it is just the scale of it, which I suppose was different from the theatre projects you'd been working on at that time. Suddenly, you're confronted with enormous forces, or did it not feel like that?
Oh, it felt like it. But even still feels like it when you're writing. You feel these forces, and you feel, you know, when you're writing, you absolutely can feel this sort of surge of it coming. You know it's going to be hard work. It was really, really difficult. I worked 7 days a week. I was until 12, and, you know, I'd never, there was no music editor. I had the Carl Knudsen book, and for those who know about that, he was a precursor to computers. This guy called Carl Lewis came up with this click track book. And Larry Ashmore, the orchestrator on it, had to teach me how to use this thing. It took 3 hours almost every day to map out the cue before I wrote a thing. And you had to mark in every two bars by hand, you know, sword, lances, you know, I don't know, chest, whatever, you know, horse falls, blah, blah, blah. And then when it came to the recording session, Simon Rattle threw all the clicks away and conducted it wild. I wanted to kill him. You bastard, you know. He was so, so clever, you know. I wanted to kill him, you know. But if you know it's a measure of your work, Patrick, you know, you get in there, you know. He sort of got the rhythm of it. I mean, I knew that picture inside out, every nuance, every kind of inflection of Ken Branagh's. I watched it and watched it and watched it more than I've watched any other picture. I was so terrified, you know. And I must actually, before you show this clip, I apologize for the out of tune singing, because I had some kind of Strasbourgian kind of thought that maybe I should sound tired and out of tune. Bad idea. So it should have been Showbiz. But anyway, on the album, you can hear I actually sing in tune. So please, please, I'll sing along with it, actually.
Just to explain that to people who haven't maybe seen the clip. So you start the scene, and it's you in shot singing this. How did that come about?
I played the part of Alexander Court. He's got one line. But to actually spend 6 weeks on the shoot and to watch it all take place was just thrilling. That was a natural progression from theatre to the film in that I knew all the actors. I still know all these actors. They're great friends. Fortunately, I've known people like Robbie Coltrane and Emma and all these people. I knew long before they were famous, long before they enjoyed, I knew Emma long before she joined, she got married to Ken, and I was a member of the Renaissance Theatre Company, and Robbie, we worked together in my days as an actor. We back in the Traverse Theatre in a play called The Slab Boys, which has been revived by the same director in January next year at the Glasgow Citizens. So to be on the set with, I remember Ian Holm came up and he sort of grabbed me one day like this and said, "This is a good picture. It's very important." I'm like, "Uh-huh." And just, "It's an important picture." And I said, "You've got lines to learn, darling." So, and then after the premiere, he was like, "I'm so sorry, it's wonderful." You know, he was shitting himself, like, what is he doing? He can't be an actor and doing the music here. He didn't, it sort of got more worked up, you know. I understood his neurosis, but I thought, I'll be fine. But it was fine, you know. And of course, the non-nobis is hello. I don't know.
But do you go through various versions, or at what point do you hit the thing?
You just know, I think. Look, the thing is, I didn't know I wrote melodies in my head. I thought they were shit, you know. No, I thought people would think they were shit. I thought they were good in my head when I was a kid. I just remember that melody was written in 5 minutes, and it happens. I was in the back, I was in the foyer. Ken described the whole scene, and that's what he shot. And that's his habit, you know. And it's a bit like Hitchcock in that sense. He's mapped it all out, a lot of it anyway. So he described the whole scene and how it would have to build. I'd written it without this section in the middle. That was written behind the set of Much Ado at the Phoenix Theatre. And I remember thrashing that middle section out. And the tune itself was written in the foyer of the Theatre Royal Manchester. In the foyer, I wrote two versions for Ken. Strange, because Lyle Ashmore said, to me it was odd, but to him it wasn't odd. He said, "That melody does, it goes where you don't expect it. To me, it goes obviously the way it should go." I'm not sure what he meant. He said to go up again, I wouldn't do that. And I thought, well, why would you do that? Because I've done that. It seems natural. I wrote it just came in 5 minutes, and I thought of it as a kind of, collegiate thing, almost a sort of college, with a sort of college hymn, a sort of an alma mater thing. Strange enough, Ken gave me, as a model, although to this day I've never heard it, the Paul McCartney Frog song. But I took that as Tomorrow Belongs to Me from Cabaret. You know, the boys standing up, that chilling scene where they all join in. I think you do have images of other things that you've seen before. It's imperative, I think, as a film composer, that you embrace all the arts, as Wagner suggested. And did. I think you've got to really be aware of everything, and it all comes into play. The fact that people, when I people first responded, started responding. I remember the very first thing I wrote as I was 16, a little string quartet, and I was completely blown away when my friends at the junior college at Royal Scottish Academy played this thing. It was a wee thing, it was a bit of Debussyan. It was math, I suppose. I thought, well, that could be the viola, that's the second, that's the first violin, that's the cello, it's as simple as that. And when they played it, it was like orgasmic. It was like, oh my God. And my friends went, "You wrote that," you know. They were sort of amazed. I thought, that's great. You're like a pop star, you know, you think. And people liked that. I heard that and people liked that. And that's the thing that's planted. And that went back into my little box again, all through the academy. And in fact, I was given a punishment by Stanley Thompson to talk Harmony Counterpoint. As a punishment, it's a mock punishment. He said, I want a trio by next week. So I wrote this little trio for piano, cello, and violin, and cellist. Shoni McFadden has got she's got a bit of a fishwife mouth. She went, for fuck's sake, do you fucking write this shit, you know? I mean, thank you very much, Shona. The finishing school was really successful. But it was, I'm glad you went to Switzerland. Give my love to Geneva. But it was, the piano part was rather ropey, but it was sort of cobbled together, really. Again, these little things that I thought, you know, these, again, full of little tunes and stuff, so, I don't know, sometimes it can be a hindrance writing melodically, because very often it's not necessary. And I've been asked to, just literally, as I said, I'll take the theme away and leave the viewers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm struck by that scene. It's not the kind of filmmaking we see very much anymore, that kind of space for the melody to expand.
It's a gift for a composer, and of course there's absolutely no sound, whatever. It's just the music. It's an absolute gift, a glorious gift, and that's the thing about Ken. He's a really amazing person in that he does give every department their moment, you know, and more, and many moments. He loves music, absolutely loves music, and he's got a real soft heart, as we all have, but he loves a good tune, which I like to write. His parents are like my parents, working class Belfast, working class Central Scotland, same ethic, same work ethic, the same morals, the same sort of philosophy in life, and it's just get out and get on with it, and just work hard. And be twice as good as anybody else, because if you're not, you'll not get anywhere. You know, that just get up and get on with it. So I sort of really had an instant affinity with him. It was just instant. I thought this guy is unbelievable when I met him. I was quite disgruntled with theatre because I felt there was a lot of bad directors around. I can't talk about it now, but certainly then was. I thought a very uninspiring people, and this guy started to talk, and I thought everything he said made total sense. I was about to just give up the business when I met him. I'd actually made up my mind. I was sort of getting fed up with, just disillusioned with not finding anyone in my wavelength. I thought, I just don't... Anyway, so when he came along, I thought, my God, he was extremely smart, extremely erudite, really well-read, just normal. There was no pretension. You know, there was no elitism about it at all, and it's still the same. He's not grand, and he's just prolific. And he, you know, even Stephen Fry said, Mr. Sort of Smartbox said, he's met nobody brighter, nobody brighter. And my daughter interviewed him, she did through many of my contacts for a school magazine. She said, Dad, that guy is formidable. He's the most intelligent. And she interviewed Stephen and various other people, and said he was unbelievable.
But how do you talk about music on a project, the two of you together? Does he kind of leave you to it?
No, he talks about character. He talks about narrative. He talks about, he'll throw references out to, like a tent track. He'll throw, I don't want to be the orchestration to be too big. He knows about orchestration, and he can sense what's big and small, what's medium. And he'll say, I don't want it too big. I don't want it too, too Wagnerian. I don't want it to be too, too lush or too romantic, Yeah, I don't want to be baroque. He'll throw these. It's very funny because, initially, when he was just starting out with me and Henry V, he'll come up with kind of like, he'll mock the kind of Italian language that we all use. And he'll go, darling, can I have it more loud, Riccardo, darling, and soft Riccardo, and shut up, Riccardo, darling. It's very funny. But and he'll go out and he'll pick a really succinct phrase and give an instruction to the orchestra, and they get it instantly. He does what I do. I talk and describe, even though they can see it. I still think it's nice to communicate with the orchestra and talk about your passion for it, even though they can see it. you suddenly get a sense of what you see in it. You go, oh, I'll just show it. No, I don't want you to show it. You're just going to have to put up with me telling you about it, because my enthusiasm is what I want to inject into your playing. And he's the same, that passion for it. In me, as he says, to write a simple tune is the most difficult thing in the world. And it is to write, you know. I mean, the waltz of Cinderella, fortunately, I will not play it because I get sued.
Cinderella is due out later this year?
Yeah, it's just coming out.
Yeah.
But the waltz of that's a very simple waltz, and it has to be absolutely direct. And he was thrilled with it, and I was really pleased with it. I thought about it. He talked and talked and talked about the characters and about the concept of the movie, and he just talked and partially about the narrative. And he said, this story is, and as I found out myself, Cinderella goes back to Greek times. The story is 2,000 years old. And he talks about these pieces as if he's talking about a work of Shakespeare. He doesn't in any way belittle it or talk down to it. It's an absolutely, it's a very important thing to have a film for children, that they see this character is a representation of what maybe they could be or not something they wouldn't relate to. So he passionately sort of drags you into, you know, a world of, you would say Shakespeare, you think you're talking about Hamlet. I spoke of Cinderella like a leading Shakespearean character. And if you see the film, that's what comes across. No one is over the top. No one's chewing the furniture. Everyone is being real. And the scene between Cinderella and the stepmother at the end is absolutely chilling. It's fantastic writing. And it's utterly chilling. And you're watching two adults talking about their lives, you know. You think you've got it bad. It's just, Cate Blanchett is riveting. I think it's the best thing he's ever done by a mile. It is absolutely fantastic. It's so unbelievable that all the actors, he just pulls the best out of actors. He's a genius with actors. I've seen him work, just I've seen them the way he moves in and he leaves things alone. It's working really well. And they're just, you'll see just things like, oh, just physical things like, darling, your eyes, darling. Small with the eyes, don't they? Too poppy, aren't too poppy. Eyes are too poppy, darling. You know, and you're like, oh Christ, you know, and I find it impossible to close my eyes. So all those little physical things, and it's great. And he'll come back maybe 5 minutes later and he'll give you a bit of direction that way. He won't sort of go in it right away, he'll do something else, allow you, and just creates this incredible confidence in everyone. And an environment that's full of. But it's so unneurotic and unhysterical. It's just that why can't it all be like that? You know, because it is in the end, we composers know what they're doing. They know what to do. And when you're left alone, as example with Robert Altman in Gosford Park, I wrote it in nine days. I wrote the score in 9 days, like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and I have weekends off. 5, 10, and maybe 10 or 11 days actually. I wrote it over like two and a half weeks. You know, I had Sunday, Saturday, Sunday off. Because nobody, Robert never bothers you. He just let you get on with it. And that's what Ken does. He just allows you to just do your best work.
Yeah. We're going to come back later on to your relationship with Kenneth Branagh, but we want to jump forward quite a while to 2011. And we want to talk about a film called La Ligne Droite, The Straight Line.
Yeah.
And this is another long-standing collaboration of director Régis Varnier.
Yeah.
How do you, I mean, just following on from that kind of conversation, do you have to adapt then to different directors?
Well, again, very fortunate. Régis is so in so many ways like Ken. He is a highly intelligent, he's a class act, a class French act. That's just a vaudeville thing, isn't it? No, he really is an extremely smart animal, and he's a multilingualist, really smart guy. And he had seen the dubbing of Henry V, and that's why he kept seeing it being dubbed by Depardieu. And he thought, what is the music in the background? And that's how I got the gig. And I think I've done maybe 6 pictures with him. But he loves music, and he loves a lot of music, unlike a lot of French directors. They like a lot of silence, and he likes music in there and gets criticised for it. But I'm very fortunate that we just clicked. You do something, you click instantly. In fact, the first time I met him, he said, afterwards, I was going home. I met in Paris. And I was so chuffed, so young. I'm going to Paris, it was so exciting. It was ridiculous. It was just looking back, going, anyway, it was great. And he said, after, he said, Patrick, of course, you will do all my movies. I said, but I haven't written anything yet. Doesn't matter, you will do all my movies. I said, but what if I write shit? He goes, impossible, no, no. You will do all my movies. And I mean it. I mean it. And that's what he does. And he did mean it. And I've done all his movies. It's just been amazing. He's just an incredible guy, very, very funny. Got a wonderful funny bone, and we just spend the whole time laughing. But this picture, I said, afterwards, because I had to orchestrate it, I had to conduct it, which it's exhausting. Orchestrating and conducting and writing a bloody thing. You know, a lot of help from Rupert Cross, by the way, but who was working on this. It was just exhausting. And of course, I was in there giving it, you know, with a sword. And Regis, he said, oh, Patrick, I did not see you. For 2 days you've been conducting. I said, well, Regis, there's no money. That's what happens, there's no money. I can't pay someone to do that for me. I'm in there myself. You know, there's no fun, there's no giggles. I said, so next time, before I laugh, give us some more money. possible. You know, I said, well, that's what happens. We've got to do everything, and I don't do everything. It's just too, it kills you, you know.
Aside from the conducting, you conducting it, which we might talk a bit about later, are there other differences then on having to work on a lower budget film? How does that limit you or restrict you, or how does it give you more room for creativity?
I remember I was years ago, and you were asking me about the sales thing, about a smaller budget, and the composers were slightly kind of moaning slightly about the fact that, oh, you've got all these resources, these big movies, and you think, sorry, you know, Haydn wrote some extraordinary chamber works, as did Schubert, and made a career out of it, and Mozart, the Beethoven Last Quartets. Sorry, you know, we all love writing. If I was asked to do 5 chamber scores in a row, I'd be thrilled. You know, it's just the same amount of work. I apply the same passion and dedication and neurosis, whether it's a string quartet or whether it's a big orchestra like the CBSO. So the whole carp about the fact that you've got a large forces at your disposal, you know, it's massive doubling going on. That's all it is. You know, the art of writing is a string quartet. That's how all the great masters had learned to write. If you can write a chamber work, you can write anything.
Can you tell us then a bit about the concept for the score for this film, La Ligne Droite?
Well, the thing is, it was about this two runners. One is blind, and Regis had he loves sport, and he loves a lot of documentaries, filming sport events. He's well known in France for that. And he saw this event with the blind runner. They have a wrist thing that joins them together, and they have to be in total synchrony. And he's just fascinated. So he wrote this script about that very thing, and they end up sort of falling in love. But it's a relationship that's fraught with tension because of the nature of the neurosis, the race, and the complex emotions that go into that kind of partnership, and the motorized I thought of these kind of running sort of minimalistic sort of mechanical rhythms, but he wanted melody on top of that, so it was a mixture of that, but it was a small. I can't remember how many pieces. Maybe about 12 piece. Just piano and strings and harp. But it had to be, there was a couple of cues, 2-3 cues, but where they were doubled with a larger string orchestra, because it needed it for the imagery for the wide stadium shot at the end.
You mentioned, I think you even used the word minimalist before.
Yeah.
Were you thinking of minimalist music?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. It's out there. You have to be aware of these things. You have to be completely, we call it the Zeitgeist Half Hour. We have Zeitgeist Half Hour in the office. Every day we watch trailers, we watch what's out there. Rupert Cross will tell us what's happening in German modern modernism, or who's the latest sort of band that's out there, or you know, the kids, I listen to the kids, their dance music, or dubstep, or God, whatever we listen to. Everything's out there. It's all part of the melting pot, you know. That's always been the case. I think, you know, you've got to embrace these things, and it's in there, it's all in our subconscious. But you can hear, for me, I can hear Schubert in there, you know, the famous B-flat trio, you know. The first classical music we were asked to study, it was chosen by P.F. Johnson, who was head of music for Lanarkshire. In fact, I'm going back up to Lanarkshire to go back to my roots, as it were, and they were doing a performance of a silent movie with kids from Lanarkshire. And Rupert's coming up, and then the plan is to do the full movie with these kids from North and South Lanarkshire, and then maybe do another performance with kids from all over Scotland, to do a silent movie and to do more film work for these kids. That's what I want to do, more of that. And they just are so excited. I've already done a workshop, but I don't know how people got onto that about P.F. Johnson. He looked a bit like Billy. Oh, you know who Billy Wonder was? Wee round guys. One of those things you push over and it comes back up again. What it was called. And he looked a bit like Schubert, you know. And he chose music for strings, percussion, celesta, Bach, the E major violin concerto, the Tannhäuser overture, Died on an Ace, the opera, the Schubert, and you know, seminal, you know, just seminal moment in your life when you're studying these great, great pieces of music, you know, and huge influence on me. I still love listening to Schubert Lieder, and everything out there is up for grabs. People steal from me, I steal consciously, subconsciously. One of the people, oh, see, that's a good idea. I'll try this version of that. I mean, it's all, you know, Bansky's, you know, he's got two people on the phone, and the latest thing I saw, fabulous. Everybody's like out there. Dario Fo said, steal, steal, steal again. I mean, don't steal, you know, I don't steal exactly, but you think that's a good idea. People, I hear my scores in scores all the time. It's a fact of life. The things tend with them. You know, Chris Benstead, who is part of my team, he's Mr. Temp Track genius, and he drives me mad. He's out there. Right? He's so good at it. I thought, where can I go from here? You know. So with Jack Ryan coming up, I get in with Rupert Cross earlier, and I said, right, okay, I want to spend a month in this thing. I want to subvert the Temp Track. This is a temporary track, for those who don't know, that goes up in the picture, and you've got to try and get out of the way and write your own score, because you use it to preview it with audiences. So we spent, Rupert's got this incredible gear, I said, I want new sounds. I was making noises and shouting at him, and this, I want something that sounds like this. I wanted the feeling of the third man, the sort of lonely guy abroad. And I wanted, you know, that da 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 da, I can't forget the composer. That kind of feeling that the third man gives you. I wanted that feeling, but I wanted much more modern, obviously, with modern sounds and pulses and all sorts of things. And what was great was the studio fell in love with that.
We're going to come on to Jack Ryan as our... We've got something else first.
Okay.
But I just wanted to follow on from that and to link a bit. This is a small ensemble, but you're working with the principals of the LSO. And you've had a long relationship with the London Symphony Orchestra. Why is that? Why do you want to work with that named orchestra rather than a session band?
Well, it just happened. I used them once, enjoyed it so much. I felt so comfortable, and great players. Morris was still alive then. God rest him. And Morris Murphy, the great trumpet player. And they just did a fantastic job. Unbelievable, just unbelievable ensemble playing. They play together all the time. So they were fast as the session guys. I mean, I filmed with some session guys at the beginning of the year, and they were amazing. the ladies and gentlemen, not guys, the ladies and gentlemen of the orchestra were amazing.
So there's no question, you know, when LSO went available, I willingly and, you know, embraced it wholeheartedly. I looked forward to it very much. We had a wonderful time, and they were very, very complimentary, and they came into the booth. But it just, you know, it's this thing has evolved. It becomes like, you know, like a family thing. I suppose with Ken, he uses a repertory of actors. You get into the groove of it. And they walk around my schedule, I walk around their schedule. You know, it's just the way it's evolved, and you begin to write for particular players. It's just, you know, but, you know, I could maybe use an orchestra sometime. Who knows? It depends. Maybe a filmmaker decides, I want to use a group. That would be fine, and he would understand that. It's a business we're in, you know. But they have a unique sound, and I believe they like playing my music a lot. They enjoy it. We have fun at the sessions. Ken's great fun, and I've used them with other directors, and Regis loves them, and so.
Okay, and just want to move us on then to talk about Brave, which the LSO are playing on.
Yeah.
This is 2012. So this is a fabulous animated film, of which you've scored a number now. Mm. Is there a difference between scoring animation and live action or not for you?
And I suppose the only difference is that it's very, you have to be precise down to the movement of a pair of eyeballs. In that sense, it has to be, they call it Mickey Mousing. It's quite a derogatory term, but one uses gentle Mickey Mousing in other areas. You have soft hits, as you call it. But no, it's a drama, it's a narrative, and it's about characters. It's about choosing instruments that suit certain characters, certain situations. You know, the sonorities are everything, and, you know, I sort of instinctively pulled on my roots for the, but I still went back and did some research. You know, things get rusty, you forget things. In essence, it's the same. It's the same principles apply to live action as does to animation.
Okay, so you were saying that you've drawn on your roots. Of course, this is a film set in ancient Scotland. There's a Celtic tradition there.
Yeah.
How did you negotiate that? How did you feel about engaging with that tradition?
Well, it's interesting that as a sort of a technical exercise that a lot of the melodies come from, a lot of the melodies are within a ninth of a range and sort of chanter range, really, which is part of the bagpipe. And the bagpipes are not in B flat, they're in B they play, although all the textbooks are in B flat. So you're always better checking with these players. Look at Wikipedia, and Wikipedia is very often wrong. They go, oh, it is in B flat, but we're playing B. I thought, well, why don't you just change Wikipedia? You know, well, that's just, nobody's bothered yet. Okay, fine. So it's just weird. All the melodies are, most of the melodies are within this range. It's a great discipline to write a tune within that small register that's very effective. And bizarrely for this picture, in their enthusiasm for involving the composer very early on, they said, could I write the music for the trailer? I thought, well, I haven't written a thing yet. So they sent me the trailer, I thought, dear God. So I wrote this tune. Again, in that small range. Anyway, I just wrote the trailer. That was all I wrote. And they loved it. And I thought, oh my God, I can't believe it. You know, you're doing the trailer, and of course, I forgot all about it. And as I started to write the score, Mark said, what about that tune you wrote in the trailer? I said, well, did you like that? He goes, yes. It went all over the world. We quite liked it. Can we have that? I thought, great. I thought they'd just like thrown that aside. I'd sort of like toss it aside because I had to come up with it shot from the hip, as they say. So very often you don't have time to think. I just pulled on my roots immediately.
Right.
But then I got into it and I thought, no, obviously they were very good about allowing me to use, of course they would do that. But I automatically chose great Celtic players. With all due respect to the guys who play Celtic music down here, but there's something about someone from the Orkneys who plays that tune. You think there's just something in your DNA. And even if you haven't got that particular DNA, but I'm sure we've all got the same DNA, really, we're all Africans. But we are, aren't we? From Five Folk. How did they come about, those Five Folk? Let's not go there. But the thing is, you know, there's something in us all can feel when it's the real deal. We really can feel that. And it's tingle territory when the guy started. All of them. Jim Sutherland was the sort of fixer producer, and he found these great players in the whole Celtic scene, and Lauren McDougall, who's part of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, were unbelievable. I thought, what are these people going to be like? You know, that chili dripping off their. I thought it was some food fest or something coming through the chanter, but they were amazing, absolutely amazing to have four pipers. You know, tuning up in the middle of Ireland, I was, oh my God. I just thought, well, we'll have to find a war somewhere, you know. It was incredible. It was just unbelievable.
Can you tell us a bit about working with the Red Hot Chili Peppers? Because I'm struck about the difficulty of trying to orchestrate when you've got pipes.
Well, the thing is, pipes involved. You know, all the brills and turns and all these melismatic figures that are in there. You know, you can approximate it in the demo, but they have to do the thing, and they'll talk amongst themselves. Well, we have a burl there, you know, I can't remember all these expressions now, they'll all talk amongst themselves. Yeah, we'll do that. What do you think of this party? And they'll just talk amongst themselves, and you leave them to it. It's like jazzers. You don't get involved in all that. They're like, yeah, right. What do you know about it? They just want the tune. They can put I had put a few a little sort of demo versions in there, but as a guide, really. The director really loved that. He wanted that. He loved that kind of that sort of barn dancey thing that he heard it as throughout it. So that was great. And a couple of 2/4 bars in there because they added some footage. That's just a wee round. You put a 2/4 bar in back into the compound time again. Yeah, you leave it to these guys who put the turns and melismas and little gracelets in themselves. You let them do that. You don't interfere.
But what about orchestration? Because you're also using ullion pipes, so small pipes.
Yes.
In this, is that because it's just hard to do things with the Highland pipes?
Well, but yeah, they're limited. The Highland pipes and the ullion pipes have far more flexibility, and you can actually write more intricate melodies with them, and chromatically and everything else. So they're far more. Plus, it's a beautiful sound, although it's not a Scottish pipe, but it's only 2 hours away. Please give me a break. You know, I'm sorry. You know, let's not get all wound up here, really. You know, and apart from, you know, at 50%, at 1.5% of the population that will see it in the UK, you know, let's not get wound up. But seriously, though, it's a gorgeous instrument. It's so evocative and it was perfect for so many parts or so many areas within the score, and it blends so beautifully with the pipes and other flutes and all sorts of things. So, your choice. I also use Chamberlain, I remember, and you know, all balalaikas as well. They're there. It doesn't matter. You know, they're all part of that kind of same folk blend that comes from the East, all over Europe. You know, this is a Bulgarian music, and you think it's from the Highlands. You listen to Cantonese music and you do think it's Highland music. So I remember being in a restaurant in Glasgow and I thought, this is from the Highlands. And they said, no, it's Cantonese music.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of unnecessary kind of like angst about that. As long as it's, you get the total flavour of where you are, gives you the geography, that's...
Okay. I was struck in that by how closely the music is reacting to shaping the action, driving it, but also having a kind of an overall dramatic arc.
Yeah.
To it. How do you go about thinking about a scene like this? What are you trying to do in a sequence like this?
Well, the thing is, when she's trying to get this, when she throws the thing, clearly that's Mickey Mouse, I suppose. You have a sustained chord. It gives you a sense of, it starts off quiet and it swells to give you a sense of her pushing this chair to try, and it carries on, and she's trying to prise the door open with the iron bar. And I very often use dance ballet. Oh, these helps you. These are what I'll do when I write is, I'll do it most of the time, is I choose a tempi, and that's a tempi that runs for maybe 4 minutes sometimes, and it just half a tempi, and so on. That way you're not changing tempi all the time. It's just one. Because the public I've got, the punters are watching it, they're subconsciously, they've got this rhythm, this sort of tempi along with you. I to me, it's a device that I use. I can't remember if somebody told me. Maybe Roy Prendergast suggested it, a music editor I worked with many years ago. And I've adopted it, liberally. I think it's a very... This particular cue, if I remember, I wrote it, one of the first cues I wrote. And then I had to write a cue further that I had to bump into that. So then I had to prepare this cue to launch itself into that quite a way, if I remember. Chris, I'm sure that's the case, Chris. Chris Benson said he works close to me. So that's the way I worked it. I was slightly anxious because it was set in place and they loved it. And I thought, okay, anyway. But it happens, it's a craft. So much of it is a craft. You work out how many beats you've got, and you make sure you get there in the set amount of beats. But I think music should, as much as possible, have, this organic sort of, art to it. And I think the skill of the great composers is that they know how to take, a germ or an idea and develop it and develop it and develop it, and it grows and grows and grows. That's once you get more experience as a writer, you come up with a simple theme and you think, oh, I mean, I remember when Henry V, if I remember this. I thought, what did I do with that? But it's all over it. It's all over it. And I remember in Dead Again, Ken Branagh grabbed me and said, darling, we're shooting a scene tomorrow. We need the big theme for the composer who's been struggling with. And I said, but I haven't written it. That's meant to be for a month from now, but it has to be for tomorrow. I said, so am I? He goes, now. I said, well, you're here. He goes, hey, now. I went, okay. So we're in the old studio in Parliament, and I just wrote, da-dee-ra-bom, body. And I thought, that'll do, that's lovely, darling, that'll be. I said, but, it's all over the movie. It's all over the film. So, again, you that's the skill. You've got to learn how to develop something and let it grow and blossom and flower, I always try to change, and I think you'll die as an artist, any kind of artist, unless you change and change fast. I knew I had to change when Four Scores came along about 14 years ago, and I couldn't do any of them because I wasn't demoing at the time, and word got out. Word got out very quickly. Well, he doesn't demo. It's a very small business. So I bought the computers that sat there for 9 months staring at me. open me up again. I don't know what to do. People came in, eventually they opened the box for me, and I got into it. Before I start a project, I think, okay, what's needed here? Okay, and this film, I deliberately went out absolutely to subvert the process, and I can recommend if people can do this. It means doing less work. It means concentrating more on one job. And a lot of guys, I can understand that they get busy and they offer a lot of work, and it's another scene, and it's happened to me in 4 films a year, and they all, because 4 pals come along, and all the films bump into each other, and it's pretty hairy, but you get through it. But as a rule, I don't like to do that. And I spent 4 weeks on that sequence. 4 weeks, Rupert will tell you that. developing those sounds. And we discussed it with Rupert Cross. Rupert's, you know, and Chris, both of them are fantastic. They've just got an amazing knowledge of what's fresh and new out there. And I said, okay, I remember what years ago I did a comedy, bizarre little comedy, British comedy called Blow Dry, and it was Sally Ellen Rickman, who's a very, very good friend of mine. Sorry about that, Miguel. Marvellous. But I've known her forever. I've known her since 1978. Been pantomime. And he goes, what have we come as? I said, Broker's Man number one. He said, are you funny? So I'm very funny. He said, we shall see, I'm coming tonight. So Kim and I, and the following day he goes, I came last night to see you. You were very funny. approval indeed. He's been a great fan ever since. How did we go into the subject of that?
We were talking about reinventing yourself
and
the engagement with technology.
And you have to, because I said, I want completely new sounds. I want this to be like the Third Man. I want this. And there's something about this guy. I want in his head. I want you know. We use all sorts of pulse things for Thor, but I want this something to be really, so Rupert came up with this amazing sense, oh, I love that, and I would, it's a small comedy, and I remember I worked with a guy years ago, because I got so fed up, I kept hearing my same voice all the time, and I thought, about this young guy, he was a great guy, and he had all this gear, long before people were doing, and this guy was writing, making his own sounds, he's in late teens, and I would shout strange noises at him, and he would recreate them electronically and remix it with the orchestra, and it was fantastic. And that's the same sort of principle in this. You know, we worked for ages, and this feeling of dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum, that kind of tiny wee rhythm, and with a slight echo, that sort of delay in it. That's sort of in your head, and it reminds me of sort of da 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 dum da da. That's the same vibe of the Third Man, you know. And I think that's important, you know, for students of film, that you absolutely have to be aware of the history of film and good scores and effective scores and why they were effective. That kind of like lonely thing I want to do, and also the studio. A great note came through after one of the previews, because when Chris came in later on, he was working on another project. All the other music in the film, the temp track, was part of that 20-minute, eventually a 20-minute sequence of my own writing. And everything, as much as possible, matched the vibe I'd set up in the score. Whenever temp music you could find, it was as near as possible within the constraints of not a brand new custom-made sound. When the studio came back, after when the preview went really well, they said, we love the temp music, and they went from there to there, and that was all the weeks of work that I'd spent on it. Now, those guys are going to be thinking, that was a bit their word goodbye, that's the original score. Fantastic, you know, great confidence. You're instilling confidence in these people, and they'll leave you alone. They don't have to worry about that, there's no fires there. Don't have to put that fire out. Put a fire out somewhere else in that picture. Leave them alone. So all this is important in terms of your comfort when you're making the picture. You can subvert it, you can, at times, you know, make your life easier. It's not always, it's not possible to control this massive machine, which is Hollywood in a picture, but very often you can by getting in early and get your voice in early and getting them pregnant, you know, with it. You know. That's the term you use.
Yeah.
That's the term you use. You get them pregnant. They actually, sort of, they meet you, they like you, and you get them pregnant. They enjoy, you know.
This is where I've been going wrong.
That's the term they use. That's the term they use. I'm only quoting other people. We don't use it in this country. Inseminate use it.
Not sure how to follow that, but...
just carry on. But it's true, though. It's true.
Maybe we can talk about one other very important sort of moment in this film, which is the Faith of Our Fathers sequence, yeah. Which is a choral, Russian sort of Orthodox choral yeah. sort of piece.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about how that ended up in this score?
Well, what's interesting, working closely, and it doesn't happen to me, it happens to other people as well, the collaborative process. I saw us at Ken, the sequence where he's praying in this Orthodox church, this character, Cherevin, is praying in this Orthodox church, and he's lighting a candle. And And I thought, oh, it's a pity there's no music there. And so I wrote this, he had it as a sort of silent sequence. So I wrote this choral piece and I played it to Ken and he loved it. And this was on the Thursday. And by the time the Monday came for filming, we had booked a whole bunch of singers, Russian singers in London who also could act a bit. And we put down a rough guide track. I wrote this and they just sang the melody. So the reason for that was that instead of being a gratuitous piece of music coming from nowhere, we gave it a geography. We actually gave it as part of, they call it diegetic or non-diegetic, I can never remember, source music. But the guys sang it to this playback. So we got one shot of these people, a small tracking shot, which absolutely legitimised using this theme. So the composer can influence filming. They can, you can change, schedules and plans. With Little Princess, most notably in my career, I wrote the sequence in Little Princess, if those have seen it, where she dances and all the snow falls and there's a guy crossing the other house and she starts spinning. When he heard the demo I'd done with my daughter, Abby, who was singing it, he completely threw all the days filming and shot this thing. He just improvised the whole scene. It's the most famous scene in the whole movie, inspired by this demo that came through. And about 2 weeks before...
But you can only do that, surely, with directors who you've developed a kind of relationship
over
time.
No, conversely. They phoned me up. I've been doing all these ragas and getting into it, and I was writing stuff, and they're all going, what is it, this shit he's writing, And they're all hating it. And Mark Johnson phoned up, and Alfonso, and I just were not connecting. We're just talking on the phone. We'd never met. And Mark Johnson phoned up and said, Patrick, it's a kids' movie, and this is all too esoteric, and and I said, oh, do you want this? And I just changed it to that, and I wrote it, and I actually played it over the phone, I played it over the phone. And he goes, that's perfect. And he put the phone down. That was it. Great. Home for my tea. Home early. That's how catchy it is. Home for tea, everyone. And that was it. And then maybe England did a demo here, Del Green Press got some great sort of sitar sounds and everything else, sent it over, and they all went mental. They played it on the set, and my daughter Abigail to sing it, we didn't actually tell her
so
she was in the movie.
You think the composer should just get more involved, basically?
Totally. Totally. And that's why, I touch wood, I've only had one score dropped. Touch plastic covering. I've only had one score dropped for sort of strange reasons, but not because of the quality of my work. It happens. But no, I think people really, they can see that you're in there and amongst it, Planet of the Apes was going haywire, and I went over there, the sleeves up and got the first plane in the morning. I thought, they're not dropping my score. I could smell it. It was rewritten in two weeks, and I thought, they're not dropping this score. Out came my kind of like Scottish Terrier. I thought, absolutely, I've been working this for 7 months, it ain't dropping this score. And of course, I went from zero to hero, as someone said, I'd never heard that before. I thought, really? But anyway, they were great. They were all terrified, and I sort of de-terrified them. It's fine. I know the picture back to front, so I even hummed the main theme on an iPhone in front of nine folk. Seriously, we were actually re-spotting it. I hummed the main theme. It was mad business at times. You've got to be ready for madness.
I think it brings us sort of neatly to close on your working relationship with Kenneth Branagh. How has that changed over the years, or is it always the same as it was?
Yeah, it's always the same. The same. Sometimes it's very tense, but it's never anything other than controlled. It's all absolutely calm, and yes, he gets annoyed. I get annoyed. We all get, that kind of like stressful sort of side to us, or we all get really stressed at times. It's a very stressful thing. The thing is, I've got his back, he's got my back. That's the thing, we protect each other, and we're in it for the right reasons. Because, I'll say to him, I know you don't want to hear this, Ken, but I feel this, I feel that, I feel this, I feel that. And they'll go, darling, it's fine, it's fine. I said, well, I don't think so. I think this, I think that, okay. And then he'll maybe leave for 2 or 3 days and then it'll maybe change after that. Mm. But I'll leave it and leave it. I'll leave it for a long time. I won't speak up about anything. They're always minor things, but it's the minutiae that make up the whole, as everyone knows. And he knows that I'm passionate, and it all comes from a place of passion. It's got nothing to do with ego. It's to do with, that's actually, I find that it doesn't make sense, or I find this is more effective or whatever in my experience. He's just very generous, and he's tough. Has to be tough. You know, before we worked on Thor, he said, you know, darling, I can't protect you because it's a big franchise now. This is not like doing, you know, and I said, it's fine. You know, I have, you know, just very protective. You know, I have, you know, worked a lot with other directors, and you know, again, you know, I really appreciate the fact that he was just concerned that he couldn't really sort of, I'd have to, you know, a lot of battles I had to fight myself. That's fine. That's fine. I know. And it's to do with, it's an amazing company, that, but it is a massive franchise. You know, you're brought in because they admire your artist and everything else, but you've still got to, as he explained it one time, he drew an analogy with the McDonald's sign. We want you to change the McDonald's sign, but it has to be that shape and it has to be yellow. But you've got to get in amongst that, and you know, and bring out your own voice. And it's miraculous you come out with any kind of voice of yours in there. But it happens. Mm. In this sort of the quagmire of it all, in the maelstrom of it, you know, you come out with your voice. I mean, that Thor, the picture of Thor that he directed, is just, it's full of humour, it's full of satire, it's full of quirky comic elements to it. He's got that kind of, like, you know, completely strange in a strange land thing, alien. It's funny. It's sort of weird that he's not quite making sense. You know, he goes into, well, I'm looking for a horse. You know, that sort of thing. And he got that guy with that ridiculous, what do you call it, cape, not a hammer, not to look like a twat. You know, he looked like a superstar. He just stood there and thought, that girl is fantastic with that hammer, that stupid big hammer. You know, I'm here, a plumber. You know, I'm here. You know, you think, well, that's that window there. New baller. You know, I'll just throw it. Oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, you don't look at all. You know, it's just, he has this incredible ability to kind of keep the cut away from looking stupid, or the set from looking too gaudy or whatever. It just worked, that picture worked. People really thought, this is great. It worked, the tone of it was bang on. So we're great pains to make the music too melodramatic, you know, which I can't be at the drop of a hat, no. So all those things, you know, it sort of works, thank God.
I want to open up in a moment to some questions, but just one final one from me. It's often at these kinds of things, I think, sort of composers say, how do you get into it, or how do you maintain your career, or whatever? What advice would you give? Could we flip it around and say, what advice would you give to directors to work with composers from your experience?
Well, I suppose, you know, most directors I find, honestly, they do actually respect the composer as much as composers can moan about it. They do respect, because it's a bit of a mystery to them, you know. And if they can sense your commitment to it, then you very soon, you know, build up a very good relationship with them, unless they're completely kind of like punch drunk by the end of the process. I wouldn't like to give them any advice. You know, because really it's to trust the composer. You know, we're there, you know, very often I'll say, you know, I don't say this, but I want to say, I'm not here to sabotage your picture. I haven't come in and thought, I think I'll screw it up for them all, that'll be fun. You're in there to absolutely help that thing along and to be part of that enormous machine. I mean, as much as I can moan about it, you know, with the rest of them, but I said, I love it, you know. I'm giving it up every 5 minutes until I do the next one. But I love the cut and thrust of it, and I quite like putting out fires, you know. I quite like when it all goes pear-shaped. I thought, really? I don't think so. I'm in there. You've got to be a fighter. The composer has to fight for his corner. And some days I don't, and Chris will go, or Rupert will say, no, get in there. You know, you think, okay. You know, it's like you're the trainer. You know, the guys are like a trainer. Get in there, because some days you're exhausted. You think, absolutely. This theme's great, you know. You know, we're all human. But at the same time, there's something there that the director can sense that you're absolutely kind of on their side and you're passionate about it, and they can't really moan about that.
Yeah. Microphones will go round. If you can put your hand up and a microphone will come to you.
Hi. Is there a scene you've really enjoyed as a viewer and you thought, this is great, the acting is great, I like this, and you've come up against the brick wall trying to score for it?
In a movie? I suppose every film you do, there's a sort of brick wall there, you've got to sort of smash it down. It's always daunting that first few days, and you've got to sort of believe in your sort of past sort of track record, I suppose. It's always daunting. You look at something, and I mean, I gave myself a little cross for my own back, rod for my own back on this in the drag line. And I pushed myself to come up with something fresh, I suppose. It's always a mildly anxious, you know, stage. I can't think of any specific picture right now. Well, I suppose Little Princess. When I saw Little Princess, it was such an exquisite picture. I thought, how the hell am I going to get in amongst this picture? This picture is just so exquisite on its own. And that's the problem. You're handed something that's fantastic. Sense and Sensibility was a tricky one because the songs, you know, really had to be a sense of the songs. I felt I had to raise the bar, my own bar, as high as I could. And I spent 3 weeks in one of the songs in that, and two weeks in the other song. And that's, you know, you would think after that it didn't flow. It wouldn't flow very well because I write melodies quite, you know, as explained, quite quickly, but it took some time. It was real, some real study took place in those two songs. It changes for each picture.
Hi. In the film Harry Potter, Hogwarts hymn at the end comes from nowhere.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the best pieces of music for a film that I've heard. Was it supposed to be featured more in it, or where did the idea come from? And secondly, could you come and play it at my wedding on the 1st of November? Because I've tried to get somebody to play it.
My agent's in the room.
Okay.
And I don't come
to... I have a very small budget, though. At the
okay.
Moment,
so, yeah. That's the best I've ever heard. That's the best question I've ever heard. But I'll come to your wedding anyway, you know.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
Well, it was that was actually one of the men, the four attempts to write the Hogwarts hymn, and it was rejected, but each one Mike felt it wasn't quirky enough or whatever. And I thought, well, I thought of it, because the hymn appears in the book, there's no music to it, and I thought it would be the school hymn, and that's how it came about. And then, but I used it earlier, and there's threads of it earlier before it appears, and it's sort of a broader state later on, but as part of it's part of many. I had half an hour of music rejected, but you know, might wanted something else, so it wasn't rejected. Nothing goes to waste. You learn that through experience. That okay, that's maybe not it for that scene, but it's amazing how things can turn up for other parts of the film. So that's the history of that thing.
We'll sort out dates anyway. It's the 1st of November.
As well, was that what
he said? He's going to sort out.
Yeah,
dates.
1st
okay,
of November. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a lot.
Hi. A lot of composers tend to start out working on their own. And as they progress, they seem to start working in a team, as you seem to do. I'm wondering, at what stage did that happen to you and how did that come about?
Well, machines made it an absolute necessity, you know. But, you know, I mean, I didn't have a music editor in my very first picture, and looking back at it, and it was just extraordinarily difficult because of that. A music editor's, you know, another voice in the room. You're not continually going over the same theme forever, and you're getting feedback immediately. You're very often I'll write a theme, and the guys will say, "What was wrong with that? What? That piece of voice? No, that's good. You know, they grab. Look, we're not having, not throwing that away. You know, and they'll grab it, and you know, it's just a voice. You know, but what I'll do is, I very often I'll work on my own and work at the piano and work at things a lot myself and. The computers changed everything. You can't survive working on your own with pen and pencil anymore. You can't. The schedules are a nightmare. The changes are continuous. The picture is never locked. It's continuously changing. So you can't. You need the help of a music editor, and Chris is as fast as can be. You know, and you have to be faster than the digits. You know, it's really. It's impossible, you know, unless you're doing, you know. And it was with Cinderella, I watched it last summer and orchestrated very, very slowly myself. A lot of the dances over a period of 2 or 3 months. You can do that yourself. You can, you know, Rupert's there, he'll help with Sibelius. I can't operate Sibelius, you know. But you put things straight onto Sibelius and Logic. It's a bit like I always equate it to Eric Fenby and Delius, you know, I'll say, give us a horns, give us a top strings, give us a double that. You know, you're throwing instructions. It's so much better to do it by hand. It does your head in, all that stuff. It does your head in. You know, it's exhausting. And in fact, the Hogwarts thing, I wrote that by hand, and all the string piece where Cedric dies. And I remember, I'll never forget it, that string piece, that elegy. It's right in the morning, you know, and it was all orchestrated. And I come out and think, I wrote it in my garage in France, we got this house in France, and at the time, it wasn't, the place I worked wasn't ready. And I wrote it in the garage. I remember coming out into the light thinking, someone had just poured some quick drying cement into my brain. I thought, I'd forgotten what it was like to write quickly in my hand. It's exhausting. If you're giving instructions to someone, it doesn't, your creativity doesn't stop because of the machine, thank God I discovered. It just means that you can actually go home at 6 o'clock and not be brain dead and not need a 10-day, 2-week holiday after a film. You know, your health comes first. I was very ill at one stage. You've got to kind of change your priorities.
So are you present now during the dubbing stage, or in other words, is there any sense of disappointment when you've put a lot of effort and strive to make a scene work? You've written the music, you think it's perfect, and then you see the wrong thing, and the music might be mixed lower, and the sound effects might take a larger chunk of
Chris, soundtrack. Chris and myself are going in tomorrow to listen to Cinderella, the whole movie, and I give my notes in the dub. Absolutely. I make choices. Some movies think, I trust those people. And I do trust everyone's Cinderella, but it's such an enormous movie. And I spent a year and a half of it. Absolutely, I want to be at the dub just to... And I'm sure it's not to do with the volume. It's to do with other things, maybe to do with other things in the picture that Ken may want my opinion on.
Is there any leeway to be, let's say, forceful in your opinion? Say, yeah, I'm adamant that this needs to be...
No, you don't... adamant is never a good idea. adamant is a very good idea when I try to throw your score out. Then you're very adamant. But that happens. It happens to every composer. Hopefully just once. But no, you can just say, you can raise an eyebrow on the roof and just say, can I ask if that's maybe louder for this reason? As long as you give a very sensible, logical reason for it, and it's not to do with your ego. I very often say it's too loud, the music's too loud. Dialogue reigns supreme, and that's the way it should be. Look at that Jack Ryan thing. I feel that choral music probably could have come up a little bit, you know, just listen to it there. But, you know, am I going to lose sleep over it? I don't think so. But when I can go in tomorrow and make a difference, you know, a small difference in terms of the quality of the whole picture, because I know Ken very well. But it's principally, of course, just to hear the score and to, you know, to decide on, you know, it and the effects just marrying well. But no, what I've heard so far is just fantastic. And Chris is terrific. Chris Benstead, music editor, he's a dog with a bone, as he knows that. He will not let anything go, and if something is not giant for the wrong reasons, he'll speak up for me. Do you want me to get a question this chat at the front? Do you want to get the microphone this guy here?
This has to be our last one, I'm afraid.
All right. Ben, you've mentioned on a couple of occasions The Third Man.
Yeah.
And we haven't mentioned any other composers tonight.
Yeah.
Do you have a piece of music score in your mind that you put on the pedestal as perfection that you'd like your name under?
No, there's no. It's very difficult. It's hard to answer that because there's so many great scores being written. And I suppose you can only talk from your. When people choose a Desert Island Discs, it's to do with other reasons apart from maybe the, you know, the measure of the work. It's emotionally, there's been an emotional resonance or some sort of event in your life that has meant, you know, when I first saw, I couldn't even tell you who did the score for Lost Horizon. I just love that movie. Robinson Crusoe, children's program on television. You know, I could sing every theme from that. It was shown every, I think, they repeated it every year, I think. But I could sing all the themes from it to this day. I suppose The Godfather made a massive impression on me because it's so bold, and so is my music. It's not shy music. The scene with the music that's playing when he discovers the blood in his hands, the way they twist the main theme around and modernises it, and it's just genius, the way that kind of like waltz. It's almost like the waltz you heard, and you imagine the waltz in... Streetcar Named Desire. I imagine that would be that's the way you would treat that waltz that Blanche DuBois hears. When I watched E.T., I thought that's extraordinary score. You thought, that's fucking brilliant, that. Brilliant. You know, those wee hands, those wee fingers. Oh my God. It's ridiculous. It's just terrific. You know, there's great scores. Jerry Goldsmith's stuff. It's endless. You know, The Third Man, only because it's so evocative and it does so little. You know, little does so much.
Thank you. We need to wrap things up, I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen. I know we could talk for a lot longer. Just some thanks. We need to thank them, the PRS Music and Academy Circle, who sponsor this event. The Royal Albert Hall team, Janet Marshall, and particularly the tech team tonight. Cassandra and Neil and the events team at BAFTA, Maggie Rodford, Laura Nalka at Airedale, and of course to our special guest, Patrick Doyle.
And thank you to you. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Can you go there?
Yeah.